You're listening to Fakeologist Audio Chat. To connect to our always-on and always-streaming audio chat, go to audiochat.fakeologist.com. This is a new and exciting way to communicate with fellow fakeologists around the globe. Each day we compress and post the day's audio into a file that can be big or small. Discover new voices and ideas that talk about media fakery like you never did before. To listen to the live stream, go to s3.fakeologist.com. Now, on with the audio chat.
Hello, everyone. Hello, this is Kay Ham, and it's December 13th, 2015, and I'm in the live stream, the audio chat at fakeologist.com. Great place to go, to speak your mind, to have a conversation. Today, I was thinking about the Syrian thing, the Syrian exodus of refugees. And it's kind of reminded me a lot of the stories I've heard from my husband, who was Palestinian, and about the Palestinian exodus of refugees. So I thought, there's so much bad information in the media about Palestinians in general. There's so much confusion about the Syrian refugee exodus. And as I was comparing the two and researching Palestinian exodus, I realized there's a lot of similarities of what's going on. And I thought, it seemed like the Palestinian exodus was a perfect case study of perhaps what's going on in Syria today, in December of 2015. I thought I would go over that today, like what exactly happened to the Palestinians from Palestinians' experiences themselves, from when the state of Israel was first the state of Palestine and then turned into the state of Israel, how all that went, how all these people were relocated. And then in that way, we could use that as an example of something that actually happened that maybe is what's going on with Syria today. Maybe it's the same type of movement of people. So that's what we're talking about today. That's what I wanted to share my knowledge that I have. I think it's a unique perspective. Not many Americans get to talk to a Palestinian family, relatives, cousins who live in the Middle East, who have experience over there, and compare that to what you're hearing in the news. So is what you're hearing in the news actually what's going on? Or is better evidence talking to people who are there? This is what we're talking about in the terms of the Palestinian refugee problem itself. My husband, a little bit of history, he was born in a refugee camp in Palestine. And I guess what happened was, his parents met in a refugee camp. Sorry, not in Palestine, in Jordan. There was a refugee camp in Jordan where his parents met. They got married, and he was born in a tent in a Palestinian refugee camp in the country of Jordan. And there's an amazing story there. And I thought, this is such good information. If people really want to know what happened and how people were evacuated from Palestine to all over, this is such a good example of how this whole system works. So we start out our story with a massacre. The whole Palestinian refugee thing starts with a massacre. Now, there have been several, but I'm going to stick to my husband's story and his family's story. In 1948, there's the massacre of Deir Yassin. So D-E-I-R-Y-A-S-S-I-N. Deir Yassin massacre. And I'm just looking at the wiki page, and my husband would agree with this, so I'm going to consider this valid information. The Deir Yassin massacre took place on April 9th, 1948, when around 120 fighters from the Zionist paramilitary group Irgun and Lehi attacked the city of Deir Yassin near Jerusalem. It was a Palestinian Arab village, not a city, a village of roughly about 600 people. The assault occurred as Jewish militia sought to relieve the blockade of Jerusalem by Palestinian Arab forces during the civil war that preceded the end of the British rule in Palestine. The residents resisted the attack, and the village fell only after a fierce house-to-house fighting. 107 villagers were killed during and after the battle, including women and children. Some were shot while others died when hand grenades were thrown into their homes. Several villages were taken prisoner and may have been killed after being paraded through the streets of West Jerusalem, through various accounts. Four of the attackers were killed and 35 injured by two chief rabbis. What? Oh, by areas. By the areas. killings. All right, well, you can read the wiki article, the Daryacene Massacre, but basically, according to my husband's telling of the story by his father, all they know is they heard about a village where some people went in and just started massacring people, just killing them, like, point blank, you're dead. Now, whether that happened, as we know today, it could have actually happened, or you just say it happens. I mean, I don't know what happened back then. I have no proof of that. But according to my husband, a bunch of people died in this one village by Jewish militia, and that set the stage for everything after that. To believe in this massacre was very important, because after this massacre, my father-in-law's story is that they knew things were bad and tense, that the British had gone, and they heard stories of Jewish militia, well-armed, in different cities, causing problems. So that the history of knowing that there had been a massacre was really all the population needed, because around, in the 50s, my father-in-law said a tank rolled through his village with a loudspeaker on it. And the loudspeaker said, "You know of the massacre in Daryacene. If you don't leave the village by whatever noon tomorrow, you will be shot." So they gave people a little bit of time to pack up just their most important belongings and take them with them as they leave. They left. The entire village left. They believed the threat from the tank rolling through their village that they will be shot. Now, one has to ask, how did Jewish independent militia soldiers get a tank in the 50s into Israel? That's an interesting question, because if I was part of a makeshift militia in my city, I don't think I'd have access to a tank. So they had cooperation from wealthy people, obviously, to get that tank into the village. But this happened village after village after village. These tanks rolled through, told people they got to be out by noon tomorrow or you'll be shot. And the villagers believed them. They packed up their stuff and left. Interesting, though, part of the story is that where did they go when they left? Well, they went to refugee camps. The refugee camps were set up ahead of time by the United Nations. So when my parents' family went into Jordan and crossed the border from Palestine to Jordan, there was a station they had to stop off first. It was a UN house, whatever, like a hut, whatever thing, already built out, already ready to do the paperwork. And the refugees stood in line when they first got across the border. They were very well managed. It wasn't chaos. They weren't dying in the streets. Well, of course, unless they were already sick. Then that, of course, happened. But for the healthy person, they stood in line and they waited to get processed. So what does getting processed look like? Well, they go to the man behind the desk from the UN at the UN Processing Center in order to get their refugee card. So all my husband's family, they all have their own refugee card that says they're Palestinian. The reason they need their refugee card is it gives them access to housing and food. And that's the basic necessity of people today, housing and food. When you get that, you're fine. Basic necessities met. There weren't Palestinians like dying all over the place from starvation, although that might have happened. But the Palestinians who ended up in the refugee camp were very professionally handled and professionally taken care of. The United Nations, like I said before, had it all set up in advance. The tents were pre-built. They were in nice little rows. For plumbing, they had an outdoor sewer system where they just dug channels. And these camps were like on a hillside, slight hillside, so that the channel of refuse could flow right down into a pit at the bottom. So they had open sewers. And last time I was in Jordan, about 10 years ago, we visited one of my husband's aunts who still lives in the refugee camp. And I'll talk in a minute how those have changed over time. And there's still open sewers today. They've not been plumbed, not even today. So a refugee camp is not a place a person wishes to stay for very long. It's a temporary situation. So these refugee camps were thought about very well ahead of the exodus of Palestinians from Israel. Because when they planned the refugee camps, they weren't makeshift at all. They planned them specifically to be on a hillside, specifically so the sewer could run downhill so they wouldn't have to plumb anything. So very well thought about ahead of time. How many Palestinian exoduses were there and how many people in each is what I'm going to talk about next. But first, let's go back to the guy standing in line in front of the UN building to get their refugee card. So you're actually a family, right? You're standing in line. When you get up to the desk, the guy wants your name, where you're from, your family's name, your children's name, your parents' name, your wife's name. They get all the family information down on a piece of paper, what village you used to live in. So then that's to make sure you have eligibility. Then you get your card, and you take your card, and you go to the refugee camp, and there's an entrance to the refugee camp, and then they process you there. So there's another building. You show them your card. Then you're assigned a refugee tent, and you're given some food. So you take your food, your family, you go into your tent, and there you sit. And that's your new home now. You got your card. You're ready to go. Every couple of days, the UN has they hand out food. So you take your card, you get in line, you get your food, you go back to your tent. You get rice, sugar, milk. And to this day, the UN still gives away food. Most people, though, like here in the United States, consider it welfare. And some people are like, I'm not taking welfare. I can support myself. But other people, they're like, yeah, I actually need this. The type of food that the UN sells them are bags of rice, bags of whole dried milk powder. Amazing, delicious stuff. Wow. That whole milk powder is used to make yogurt. It's used to reconstitute milk for baby formula. It's actually delicious. Like powdered milk in the U.S. is disgusting because it's non-fat. But this powdered milk was delicious. It was amazing. Other cereals, peanut butter. Almost a peanut butter. Well, staples, I guess, is what you're getting if you get UN food. And the powdered milk came in a silver, you know, one of those silver-lined bags with silver plastic crimped at the edges, just a bag, and it said UN whole dried milk. So the UN is putting their name on products that are given away to Palestinians. They're like, I guess they want people to know, hey, we gave this away. And it says not for resale on the bag. It says not for resale. So there's a lot of foodstuff stamped with the UN symbol, and you're not allowed to resell it, but I don't think that stops the Palestinians. They still resell it if they need money. So let's start. When was the very first exodus of Palestinians? When did that first tank roll through that first village and say, unless you're out by midnight, unless you're out by noon tomorrow, you'll be shot? Something like that. Well, I can't say it all. It happened the same way in every village. I'm not going to say that. But most likely, if it happened that way in my husband's village, most likely it happened that way in others as well. So the massacre, or the said massacre at Dar Yassin, happened in 1948. And it, you know, the thing is, when you look back, it all flows so perfectly. Because in order for the UN to build a refugee camp in advance, they had to know people were coming in advance. In order to know people were coming in advance, they knew that probably tanks would be kicking them out in advance. And in order for the tanks to know they had to kick people out, they had to have the massacre as the excuse to make people go. So in that way, could the massacre have been planned? Of course. Real or said to be real, it had the same effect on the people. Although there was no love lost at this time between the very cruel Zionist soldiers. They did very cruel things to the Palestinians, I have firsthand knowledge of. Probably could have been a massacre. I don't want to discount that. So that was in 1948, and when was the very first refugee camp, the earliest one? 1948. That's right, folks. Pretty well-oiled machine here to move people from one area to another. The very first refugee camp in Gaza was Al-Shati in 1948. It held 87,000 people. In 1948, we also in Gaza Strip have Deir Balah camp, 21,000. Jabalia camp, 110,000. This is all 1948. So three in Gaza Strip, built in 1948. Already built out these refugee camps in order to receive these refugees. The West Bank had refugees coming in at Al-Aqabat Jabr, 6,400, still 1948. Ain al-Sultan, 1948 still. And in Syria, there was Sbina, 22,000. Nirab, 21,000. Jarama, about 19,000. In Lebanon, in 1948. There was Burj al Barinja, 18,000. Ain al Helawe, 54,000. El Bus, 11,000. All in 1948. There you go. I think that was a specific and controlled effort to remove people from their homes in the most efficient way possible. Yeah. So 1948, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Ooh, Waval, 8,800 people in Lebanon. So 12 refugee camps built out for thousands and thousands of people, all ready to go to receive the Palestinians once they left Israel. A very coordinated and humane, actually. This whole effort was humane because all of these refugees went through the same process as my father-in-law. They first went to the UN building near the refugee camp. They got their refugee card. They stood in line at the refugee camp to get allotted a tent and food, and then they went to go live in the tents. That's just 1948. What about 1949? We have in Gaza Strip, there was a refugee camp of 34,000, of 72,000, of 24,000, of 66,000, and 147,000. In the West Bank, in 1949, we had refugee camps of 8,000, 8,000 again, 11,000 again, 11,000 again, 10,000 again, 2,000 again, 13,000 again. All those are separate refugee camps, all built out and all ready to receive Palestinians. They were built by the UN in full knowledge of the advance of the Palestinians coming. In Syria, there are several more refugee camps ready to receive Palestinians in 1949, one refugee camp that holds 20,000, one that holds 22,000, and then in Lebanon in 1949, one that holds 6,000, 10,000, and in Jordan. The first one in Jordan, the first refugee camp was Zarqa in 20,000. It held 20,000 people. I think that's the one my husband was in, Zarqa. We were in that camp. That's where his mom and dad met. And they got married, and he was born in a bathtub in a refugee camp. It wasn't really a bathtub. It was like a big metal tub they would wash laundry in, kind of like that. But it's big. You can sit in it. You know, giving birth is messy. There's a couple gallons of fluid coming out. You don't want to mess up things. This very well-designed exodus of people from what we now call Israel is all done with cooperation of the United Nations. So I think all this, they have a lot more knowledge and power than we realize. All right, the next exodus after 48, 49, 1950, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 refugee camps, brand new ones, in 1950, each housing from 10 to 20,000 people. Seems like the maximum they want in a refugee camp. The biggest one in Gaza in 1948 was at 87,000. There's also 110,000. And those are very large to manage. So it's between each refugee camp. His average is about 10,000 maybe. In 1951, there were no new refugee camps built for people. In 1952, they had one camp of 9,000, one camp of 20,000, and one camp of 600. That was a tiny one. And then we have also camps from, so 48 is the first United Nations built camp. And the last one was 68, I think, 1968. Well, it went on quite a while. It takes a lot of time to move millions of people. So the total number of refugees in the Gaza Strip, so there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 camps in the Gaza Strip, totaling 1,200,000 registered refugees. And it even says in the wiki, because you do have to register. In the West Bank, there's 19 refugee camps with a total of 700,000 inhabitants. In Syria, there was 13 refugee camps with a total of 500,000 registered refugees, around there. In Lebanon, there were 12 refugee camps with a total of about 500,000 refugees. In Jordan, there's a total of 10 refugee camps with a total of about 2 million registered refugees. And this took place from 1948 to 1968. Wow, 20 years. It took 20 years to remove all those Palestinians from their homes and their villages. Wow, 20 years. That's a long time. That's a long history of refugee living. But what I'd like to talk about next is what What is a refugee camp? What is its purpose? What does it do? And I think in this way, it matches very closely to the Syrian refugee camps that my husband was telling me about. Because he calls his mom, who lives in Jordan, about twice a week. He's on Facebook with all his cousins that still live in Jordan or Syria or Egypt, Morocco, all over the place. That, you know, Arabs are spread really all over. Even though you're Moroccan, a large portion of that country houses several other Arab populations. They're highly mobile these days, those that are searching for jobs especially. According to my husband and what he knows from his parents and his cousins, and he still has people living in refugee camps, is that it's really a place that's supposed to be a transition. People are not expected to live in a refugee camp for very long. All right. For example, today, I'm going to get back to refugee camps in a minute from 1948. But today, in 2015, my husband was telling me that the Syrian refugee camps from Syria, well, let's Google that. What does Wikipedia say about the location of Syrian refugee camps of today? All right, let's go straight over to the Wikipedia, Syrian refugee camps. And this has started when, does it say? All the information in this Wikipedia is from, all the data on the Syrian refugee camps is from the United Nations Refugee Agency. The UNR, the UNHCR is what they're calling it. It's the UN Refugee Agency. So again, the United Nations is involved in setting up the refugee camps for the current day Syrians that are exiting Syria. According to their own data, the United Nations Refugee Agency, which they call UNHCR, United Nations Human Rights Council, there you go, that's what they call it, human rights. Really, UN? You damn well knew in advance those Palestinians were going to be kicked out. You had the tents in advance of their exodus. And you're the human rights watch people? Holy shit. That's the opposite. But, you know, good job. At least you're feeding them. You're housing them. They're not dying. That's the interesting thing, right? They're not just killing all these people. They're letting them relocate, which is, I found interesting. All right, today, because of the Syrian problem, there's a mass exodus as well, just like the Palestinians. In Turkey, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 refugee camps. In Jordan, there's 3 refugee camps. In Iraq, Kurdistan territory, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 refugee camps. In Iraq, Kurdistan. In Lebanon, there's 2 refugee camps. In the Republic of Macedonia, there's 2. It looks like Iraq has a ton of Syrian refugees. I didn't even know that. There's the Domiz refugee camp. There's the Mokbleh refugee camp. There's Gawilan refugee camp. The Kawirgosk refugee camp. Basirma refugee camp. Kushtapa refugee camp. Dara Shakran refugee camp. And Arbat refugee camp. Wow. Shatila refugee camp in Lebanon. That's really funny because back in around the 50s, that was the 60s. The last, there was said to be a massacre in Shatila, the same city as the Lebanese refugee camp for Syrians. There was a massacre in 1982 between 700 and 3,000 civilians. Nobody knows. Anyway, but that's interesting that a city where there was said to have been a massacre is now home a modern-day refugee camp for Syrians in Lebanon. Interesting. Now, it should be noted that every one of these refugee camps is run in the same methodical way that the UN ran the refugee camps for the Palestinians. Step one, you go stand at the UN office, you declare yourself a refugee, give your family name, where you're from, your children's name, your wife's name, you get your card, you go to the office in front of the refugee camp, they assign you a tent, you take your family and you go get food with your refugee card, and then for UN food, UN-labeled food, UN-labeled packets of dry milk and rice and butter, things like that, cheeses, canned meats, and you take that to your tent, and there you go. Modern-day tents also don't have any plumbing. They're meant to be temporary, but they do have porta-potties, so modern-day camps don't have open pit sewers anymore. They have porta potties. They contract with local companies in the country where they're housed. But it's the same idea. You got rows and rows of tents neatly made for you. Recently, my husband was telling me about, well, his parents had 10 children. There's 6 females and 4 males. My husband has 6 sisters and their husbands as well. So one of his sister's husbands, he owns a large business. And what is going on with these refugee camps is you're not allowed to leave. Once you go into a country, into its refugee camp, you cannot leave. You are stuck there as a resident. You're not allowed to leave because it's like a city within a city. The host country where these refugee camps are, in order to leave the camp and relocate your home and your belongings, you have to be sponsored by a local resident. So my husband's brother-in-law sponsored several families from the Syrian refugee camp. So let's see which ones it was. In Jordan, there's 3. There's Azraq refugee camp, Mrajib al-Fuad refugee camp, and Zatari refugee camp. So his business was, he said what they do is local business people will drive to the refugee camp. Do it, because they know these people have no transportation. And they say, I need workers. So people kind of line up there, and they find people to work for who will sponsor them. Because they have no, most of these Syrians have no relatives in any other country. Or they do. If they have relatives in a country, then the relative will go to the refugee camp, and they will sponsor their relative, and then they can leave the refugee camp and enter the city. But they have to have a job. They have to be promised a job or a home or something in order to leave the refugee camp. For the people who have no relatives and there's no other way to exit the refugee camp, Arabs have been, well, this really touched me. And this is what the news should be talking about, is that we have so many Jordanians and Palestinians that live in Jordan who are trying everything, every means at their disposal. They're trying to help the people in the refugee camp. So like my husband's brother-in-law, he went to the camp specifically to find workers for his factory, specifically to give them sponsorship so that they can leave that type of life. Because no one wants to be a refugee. No one wants to live in a tent and get welfare. It's humiliating. It's degrading. People want to work. They want jobs. They want out. Nobody wants to live in a refugee camp unless that's all they have. That's all there's there. All these, and look, show how awesome Arabs are. This is not their problem, these Jordanians, these Syrian refugees. Why should that be their problem? But they see the need is so great, and they come to the rescue. It's amazing. Mohammed was telling me there's wealthy landowners in Jordan. There's entire apartment complexes that have been built, and they're sponsoring dozens of families to come and live in these for free. My husband was saying dozens of families to leave the Syrian refugee camp to go live in the city of Amman or other cities so that they can escape that type of living, to help give them a start. So even though the United Nations is sponsoring the refugee camps, again, built up in advance of the exodus of Syrian refugees, built up in advance to receive them. So the Syrian refugees left Syria, boom, right into the camps, already built out. Thank you, UN, for helping the mass exodus of people in a humane manner. So these Arabs, these local Arabs in Jordan, are taking the brunt of the responsibility for these human lives that have been moved out of their country. At first, I wasn't sure how real the Syrian exodus was, but then talking to my husband, and he's saying, and if you can see the pictures of the refugee camps, they're filled up with people. Now, right, it's the UN stating, let's see, so far, the United Nations Refugee Agency is saying that 2,291,900 people are registered by the UN. They went and got their card from Syria into neighboring countries. And they even have a graph, the data.unhcr.org/Syrian refugees. They have a graph. So in 2012, there were no refugees until, let's see, the first refugee, 10,000. Oh, my God. Same thing like the Palestinian. They had, it grows by jumps. Like one city was removed, then another city was removed, then another city was removed, then another city. So I asked my husband, how could all these people be getting kicked out from a few? How are they leaving Syria? My husband doesn't really know, and he has no firsthand knowledge of how Syrians are leaving their country. But what he said is, he told me, ISIS people are going into the village and telling people either you belong to ISIS or we'll kill you. So he said the people who don't want to belong leave, and the people who join get to stay. I find that a little odd. And I asked him, where did you get your information from? And he said, Facebook. So all of his information are stories of Syrians from Facebook. So I asked him, are they people you know? Are they friends of yours? Are they cousins? He goes, no. And he goes, what? Are the Syrian stories all made up? Thousands of actors all made up? Well, I don't know. Could whoever organization getting Syrians to leave their country be doing exactly what happened to the Palestinians? I don't know. Explode a few bombs, say you better leave or you're going to get killed. ISIS is that big? ISIS is that huge, that spread out to actually be a threat? I mean, how many ISIS members are there? A handful of ISIS idiots can move 2 million people? 2,300,000 people? A couple of ISIS idiots? How is that possible? You think the people could be, fuck you, ISIS, I'm going to shoot you in the head. Since there's 2 million people to ISIS is a couple dozen. That doesn't make any sense that ISIS is involved in the exodus of Syrian people. My next goal is to find out how the Syrians chose to leave Syria, because right now I don't have any good data on that. My husband doesn't know any Syrians who left. He only knows people here who left in advance. So the people here from Syria who left Syria, who are in the United States, they had relatives here, so they could come quite easily. They came in advance of fighting. They heard fighting was coming their way. And so they decided, because they do have money and funds, to take their money and funds in advance of the fighting. So I imagine this is probably also what happened to the Palestinians. The wealthy people get out first with all their funds and their cash. They leave, and then the people who don't have resources are the last to leave, and they end up in the refugee camps, it appears. But so far, the Syrians we know, they left in advance of fighting that was coming. How did they know fighting was coming? I'm not sure. They heard. They don't. How do you hear? They can't quite tell me how they heard fighting was coming. I've queried them extensively, you see. And I'm looking for this good data, this good information that can be trustworthy. But it looks like Syrians were first inhabiting Syrian refugee camps in July of 2012. And has been continuing around the beginning of December of 2014. There had become a total of about 1 million registered Syrian refugees registered with the UN. They got their card so they could get their tent, so they could get their food. So that was December 2014. By today, December 2015, it had doubled. It's now 2,200,000. So it doubled from December 2000, in 1 year, doubled. But the very first Syrian refugee in a United Nations refugee camp. So the first exodus of Syrians from Syria, where they got their United Nations refugee card, was in December 16th, 2011. 8,000 Syrians left Syria. 2011, this was the first exodus. My friends, they have been land clearing Syria for a long time. There was tents set up already. The UN gave them their refugee card. They went into their tent in 2011. That's 4 years ago. That's crazy. This has been going on a hell of a long time. 4 years Syrians have been leaving Syria. So let's do this year by year. In December 2011, there were 8,000. December 2012, there were about 140,000 Syrians who had exited Syria, living in as registered refugees in relocation camps, refugee camps. December 2013, there's 5,800 Syrians in refugee camps with their UN cards. December 2014, there's about 1,550,000 Syrian refugees. With their cards all registered and ready to go. And today, 2015, there's 2 million 290,000 refugees. Funny thing is, on this UN website, it also has in a red box, total persons of concern, 2,291, 900,000. Total registered Syrian refugees, 2,291, 900,000. Every man, woman, and child appears to be a security concern to the United Nations. That sounds like garbage to me. But this nonsense has been going on since December of 2011. What the heck? And I want to reiterate that the local residents, the local Arabs, they understand, especially the Palestinians, as they were refugees once themselves, they're really coming to the aid of these Syrian refugees, giving them places to live, giving them jobs so that they can leave the refugee camp, treating them with kindness and compassion so they can get off the UN welfare system. I think that means a lot. We don't see that in the news. Syrian refugees giving free housing. Company after company after company going to the camps to get people so they can exit that being a refugee and start being a human again, living a life of normalcy. All right, look forward to part two of what life is like in a Palestinian refugee camp in 1950. This has been Kaham, 2013, talking about the implications of the Syrian refugees, what's really going on as compared to what went on with the Palestinians in 1948. This is fakeologist.com.
Welcome to part two of what is a Palestinian refugee camp and how is that related to Syrian refugee camps of today. And the Palestinian refugee camps would be from 1948 to 1968, 20 years to empty all the Palestinians out of Palestine. And what I just found on the United Nations website is that the first refugee camp in Syria was December 2011, and now it's December 2015, and these refugee camps are only growing in number, and they're at about 2,200,000 Syrian refugees in 4 years have exited Syria. And we don't know when it's going to stop because they're still building refugee camps. The United Nations is, and they're still growing in number. And it seems to me they're using these Syrian refugees as an excuse, like they're terrorists or something, which is ridiculous. They're just refugees being taken from their homes. They just want to start normal life. And nobody knows that better than the Palestinians. So current day Palestinians, and I'm sure lots of other nationalities too, in Jordan, I know for sure, are offering so much assistance and help for these Syrian refugees in the Jordan refugee camps of Syrians to help them get back on their feet and start life again. So there's all these business owners sponsoring people from the refugee camp so they can exit that and get an apartment and start a normal life. And as well, there's many Arabs giving apartments for free. They have enough money. They're willing to donate their apartments to Syrian refugees. And that's not on the news. And I thought that was so cool when my husband was telling me that. He knows people firsthand who are doing all these things, whatever they can do. And this is a strive not just for my husband's relatives, but all the Arabs. If they are Arabs of means and have access to wealth, they seem to be extending a welcome hand and a helpful hand to get these Syrian refugees feeling like human beings again. And I just thought that is so cool. We don't hear that awesomeness in the news, that people are taking it into their own hands. They're doing what they can to help these refugees. And it has to be stated that a refugee camp is no place anyone wants to stay for a long time. It's just transitory. However, let's back up now, back up to 1948, to present day. There's an interesting story to be told that my husband told me about life in a Palestinian refugee camp. So how life works is when you first get into the refugee camp, like I said before, first you have to stop at the United Nations building, get your refugee card for you and your family. Then you go to the refugee camp, you get your number for your tent, then you go live in your tent. And now you have your refugee card to get food and stuff so you can live. So housing and food are provided, shelter and food. But still, you're sitting around doing nothing all day. Men who are used to working, they can't handle it. So a lot of stores popped up. So around refugee camps, you have all these people. And people want to eat more than the UN food. You want more than dried whole milk, rice, beans, and canned meat and canned cheeses. You want more than that for food. So you need to purchase food. You need money for food. So what my husband told me was local vendors came to sell to the refugee camps from all over the place. They're like, here's the people. They need food. We'll provide them food. Some of them have money. Some of them didn't. Some of them trade. They might trade their whole powdered milk, maybe for a bottle of olives, something like that, or a big jar of olives. They usually come in big glass jars. Spice up their meals a little bit there. So what my husband said is all these local vendors would hire the local Palestinian people to sell their goods to the Palestinians. And in this way, you see that people can earn money now. They're working with vendors. They save up money to open their own store themselves. And then this business takes place. People now have money. They're working. Everyone wants to work. My husband's father, he helped his father who, through working with other nut vendors, so this is my husband's story, all right. His grandfather, a refugee in a Palestinian refugee camp. I don't know if you can hear that train passing by. So he worked with nut vendors. That's what he did. And a couple other brothers, they worked together with these nut vendors, and then they saved money. Then they all pooled their money to buy their own roasting nut business, which my husband's father did up until he retired. He had his own nut roasting business. Arabs love roasted nuts. I love them today. Roasted peanuts, cashews, almonds. They're tasty and full of protein. So let's back up a little bit. So now my husband's grandfather's in the refugee camp and they're working for nut vendors. They haven't yet bought their own business and they're tired of a tent roof. They don't have money to move out yet, but they want to improve their United Nations tent. So what his father did is they put cement walls, they used bricks, the concrete blocks, and some rebar to hold them together and a little bit of cement there to keep the blocks together. I don't know what you use, but the term for that cement that holds the blocks together. Built four walls and a window, a couple windows and a door and a roof. Interesting though, the tent, after it got replaced with the tin roof, the inside portion that's open air is how they built the tent, the tin roof, and the outside portion was like a ring around the inside portion so that the women could go into the sunshine and have their privacy with their children, not worried about them walking away or playing in the open sewer pit that was where all the toilets were flushed to and all the gray water was flushed out to. And by the way, they didn't have running water either. What would happen is they'd go get buckets of water from the spigot, or if they had money, they could purchase a water tank to store their water in that way and then pay for a truck to come and deliver water to their tank. And by the way, that still happens in Palestine today in houses. And there's no running water lines. Or if they are, they're unreliable. So they have water. This is in Jordan as well. They do this. They have water trucks deliver water to the tank on your roof. So anyway, what happened was, so now the camp, instead of being tents, is slowly either one, you move out of the tent. This is like in the 1950s. I'm sure the sponsorship thing was happening as well. Or you have enough money to show you can support yourself or a business. And that's the rule before the UN lets you leave the camp. You either have to have a sponsor or show you can support yourself. It's almost like these big power countries got together and they said, hey, if we're going to move people, they shouldn't be a burden on anyone. Manage it so no one gets the full burden. And it seems like that's what's happening with the with the UN planned ahead camps. Where the tents are already put up even before the exodus of people, so they know full well what's going to happen. So that's why I'm suspicious of ISIS kicking people out of Syria, because the tents are up before they left in preparation to receive them. So it seems to me 100% like a planned operation to clear people from territory. But back to the 1950s and an example of living in a Palestinian refugee camp. So these people are tired of the cold in the winter, and tents are really cold. It's super hard to heat them. So if you had a kerosene heater and brick walls, then at least you could keep yourself warm in the winter. So that's number one. So the tents slowly got replaced with masonry walls and a tin roof, but it didn't cover the entire tent. There was an inside portion where you had open air, and that's where the smoke left for the cook stoves and for the heating, things like that. And as time goes on even more, the tin roof and the concrete block masonry walls get turned into something more stable. Sometimes they put a second story on it. If an elderly son got married and had a wife, they'd attach a bedroom to it and call it there, the newly married couple, but they'd still be at home with the family. Sometime, I think it was in after 1968, the last set of refugees entered the refugee camp from Palestine into Jordan and Syria and Lebanon. The UN stopped being the owner of the refugee camp and stopped handling it. And so what they did is the houses that these Palestinians who were never able to leave the camps because they didn't have enough funds or, you know, they financially weren't able to, they didn't have sponsors, they were handed deeds to their property by the UN in cooperation with the host government. So the country of Jordan and the UN made up a property deed, and now each of these Palestinians that initially had a cloth and wood tent, now whatever they built on top of that lot number that they were assigned when they first got there or their family first got there, that becomes their property, just like a deed, like you would own your home here in America, you have a deed for that property. Well, the UN and the government gave these Palestinians deeds to their property, and then now the UN backed out and they're completely done with that Palestinian refugee camp. And that happened with, I'm assuming, most of them. That's how the UN leaves. You get your deed and you're done. To this day though, because it is a house and it is on property, a lot of these Palestinians kept that refugee camp house in their property. They didn't get rid of it. They still own it, and relatives who are having a hard time usually get to live there. So my husband, he inherited the refugee camp house, which is now a regular house. It's like a two-story house. He inherited it from his father, him and his brothers did. And so what they do when there's a relative that's down and out, because there's no rent on these properties unless, no, there's no rent at all. There's nothing. It's just your property. You just have to pay heating, you know, your heating, your electric bill, and your water bill, things like that. So they can live there basically for free or very little money at all. But no one wants to live in a refugee camp. It's not something you're proud of. You're not like, hey, I live in a refugee camp. They don't call it refugee. They have a name for it. But that's no way to live a life, and no one wants to live that life. It's like saying, hey, I'm on welfare. No one wants to live in the camp, but if you don't have any money, you're happy to have a place to live. So right now, my husband said there is a family living in his inherited refugee camp house at this time. So slowly, the Palestinian refugees slowly integrated, when they had the means, into Jordan society, into the city of Amman, started their businesses, started their lives and their new homes. So I'm assuming the same thing is going on with the Syrian refugees, that once a country, and probably it's at the demanding of the UN, they already set it up ahead of time. Jordan, you're going to take this many refugees. Turkey, you're going to take this many Syrian refugees. Lebanon, you're going to take this many Syrian refugees. And I thought Lebanon was in crisis also. Not too much crisis, because they still put a refugee camp up, governed and managed by the United Nations. So it can't be that bad in Lebanon. So to me, it just really feels like the same land clearing that the Palestinians went through, because the same refugee camps are getting put up in the exact same order, in the exact same process. You stand in front of the UN office, you state all your data, you get your refugee card, you take that card to the office in front of the refugee camp, they give you your lot number, exactly like what happened to the Palestinians. My husband was telling me today, because some people were living in there, he was talking to a Syrian refugee family who left ahead of the bombing, who left ahead of the fighting in this case, and now they went out of the refugee camp. So the local countries absorb slowly, very slowly, all the Syrian refugees now that are in these camps. And it's a good method if you think about it. It feels pretty humane. It's a holding area, but it's not stopped yet. So I wonder how long the Syrian refugee exodus will last. So there you go. If anyone has any questions more, I could have left something out of the Palestinian refugee story and the Syrian refugee story. But if that's the information I know, and I really wanted to share it with people so they would see, like, these are just families who want to get on with their life, who are dying to get on with their life, and their Arab counterparts who are there to help them. Welcome, everybody. This is part three and my last part of what is going on with the Syrian refugees. And can we assume what happened to the Palestinian refugees is exactly what's going on with the Syrians? In the first two parts, I discussed how my husband's father and grandfather were Palestinian, became Palestinian refugees in a refugee camp in Jordan, and how my husband was born in a refugee camp. So they have full experience of life there. And he sees similarities also with the Syrian refugees. He just doesn't understand. He thinks the people are leaving because of ISIS. He thinks Syrians are leaving Syria into the Syrian refugee camps that are in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan because of ISIS. And why does he think ISIS is involved? Mainly because he sees it on Facebook. He sees posts on Facebook. He has no direct relative evidence of what's going on in Syria, except that one relative went to the Syrian refugee camp, hired a bunch of people so he could sponsor them. So in order to leave a refugee camp in a host country, you have to be sponsored by a resident of that country. Just like you would here, when immigrants come, you have to sponsor them. That's the state's way of making sure they're going to be taken care of. And this one family said they left in advance of war, I guess. They heard war was coming, gunfights and battles, so they left in advance of that, hoping not to get killed, because their stories intermixed with reports from CNN and Facebook that people are getting killed and bombed and things like that. So an interesting part is, where I elaborated in part one and part two, was how the United Nations is the one who is the world authority and power on refugees. They're the ones who register them. They're the ones who build tents in refugee camps in advance of incoming refugees, not afterwards. They're built before the refugees even get there. So how does that work? You have a Syrian dude watching TV. He's on the internet. He's like, wow, there's fighting in the neighboring village, it says on CNN. My Facebook has posts of people getting hurt by ISIS. They say they're going to come into my village next. Meanwhile, the UN has already built the refugee camp. They've already put up the tents, already brought in the porta potties. The UN knows there'll be refugees before the refugees knows they will be refugees. I think this is a big piece of the puzzle about who is really involved, who is really the power, who's holding a lot of the power. And from what I can see, the United Nations is a huge player and is in full cooperation of host countries. They're in cooperation with the UN, where these refugee camps are methodically and systematically put up and methodically and systematically accepting refugees. They're so powerful. I had no idea the United Nations held such power and cooperated with so many countries, probably with, you know, by force of threat, I would imagine. Unless all the leaders are getting along, then there's no force of threat at all. They just know they want to clear people from this land, and you guys are going to help, and it works out. My big question in part three, which I don't know the answer yet to, is what's going to replace, or who's going to replace, the Syrians that are now leaving Syria? Just like Jewish people replaced Palestinians when Palestinians left Palestine and herded into the refugee camps. I'm going to say herded in a methodical and well thought out manner. They knew exactly what villages were coming, I suspect, and they were totally prepared for their arrival. Food was there, shelter was there, it was all ready and set up ahead of time. Why did the Palestinians have to go? Why did they have to leave Palestine? Well, apparently to make room for the Jewish people they brought in. They brought in a ton of Jewish people from Eastern Europe and all over the world. I heard there were Jewish strongholds, I won't say stronghold, Jewish communities, regular communities with moms and dads, not stronghold, that's a terrible word, but I know like in Jordan, 5% of the population is Jewish and they have thriving businesses and they're successful and neighbors get along with neighbors, just like Iran, Iraq, there's Jewish communities all over these places. So that's where Israel took their population from. They invited Jewish communities from all over the world, including South America, to go and live in Israel. Who will be replacing the Syrians? Are the Syrians even going to be replaced? What is the purpose of the mass exodus of Syrians from Syria? That's my question. Who's taking their place and where will they be coming from? Or is it just, let's reduce the population here? Or is it countries like Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan want to increase their population? So the UN is helping these host countries by making refugees to do it that way? That's what it seems like. One other thing about the Syrians, my husband told me, is that he has a couple cousins who lived in Syria. They're Palestinian, but they lived in Syria. They ended up in a Jordan refugee camp. And this is his mom telling him what the cousins are up to. He talks to his mom about once or twice a week. So my husband is in full contact with his relatives back in Jordan. And so he knows what's going on with the people. And when he tells me something, I ask, how'd you hear that? He says, oh, my cousin told me. So then I tell you it's from his cousin. Sometimes he says it's from Facebook. So then there you go. I don't know if I can trust that advice. It's from Facebook. You know, the CIA has an office in Facebook or whoever, the FBI, some agency there. It's all controlled as far as we can see. And the rule is, so if you get sponsored by a Jordanian or a Palestinian with Jordan citizenship or whoever, you can leave the Jordan refugee camp and now you can live in Jordan proper. But you have to get a sponsor first. However, if you completely leave the host country, you can't come back. So his cousins, they heard there were jobs in Morocco. So they wanted to go to Morocco. But there's a caveat. If you leave, you can't come back. No coming back to Jordan and definitely no going back to the refugee camp because they're breaking the sponsor relationship, which says they can't leave the country. If they do, all deals are off. So the Syrians take a risk when they leave. They can't go back. So my husband was under the impression that's kind of where you get people without a country and Syrians with nowhere to go because they left the camp because they got a sponsor. Then they left the sponsor's country. And now who's going to help them? They can't go back to that country anymore and the host country, and they can't go back to Syria. So this is what he's trying to put together, the pieces that the bullshit, the huge pile of lies that our media tells us. He's trying to put together what CNN is saying with what he knows in reality. He's having a difficult time doing it. And Rochelle, I like what you said. I was asking, how do we come together on the same topic? And you had a great response. You said, say, like, if someone's talking about the news, say, wow, that's confusing. Does that confuse you? Or something like that. Wow, that doesn't make any sense. Does that make any sense to you? No, that doesn't make any sense. That is a great way because it doesn't make sense to me and it doesn't make sense to you. So we're both not making sense of the media. That's a perfect topic to come together for people who understand fakeology and people who don't. What I suggested was to say, like, usually when people are telling me about a terror event, they're upset about it. So the way I approach them on the same level they're at is like, wow, that sounds stressful. Wow, that sounds scary. Sounds like that's making you afraid. It sounds like that's putting fear in you. And people who I talk to, they go, yeah, hell yeah, that I'm afraid because of this and this and this and things like that. But I like that, Rochelle. Good advice. Sounds like that's confusing. You're confused by that. Huh? That doesn't make any sense, does it? They'll agree with you, I bet. And I'm going to end part 3 just by saying, I've lived in the Arab community over 30 years, and all my dealings I've ever had with any Arab ever doesn't show them to be like tending toward ISIS at all. It shows them to be people who are helping refugees today. Jordanians are going to the refugee camps and purposely to be sponsors to the Syrian refugees in the Jordan camps so that they can leave the camps and start normal lives. This is what I see. This is how Arabs are. This is what I see. When I was in Jordan, one of these last times, the gypsies had come to town. The whole, several pickup trucks full, and then they put up their tents and they make a deal with different farmers to put up tents in their field. They pay the farmers rent, and the farmers are like, yeah, why not? My crop's done for the season. We'll let the gypsies camp there. And their children are filthy, absolutely filthy. Their hair's not combed. And it's interesting. Mothers don't find it, I guess, or it's socially acceptable for a child to be absolutely filthy. And there's an age I noticed with the gypsies between when they hit puberty, like 12, 13, 14, 15, then they get old enough, they start cleaning themselves. Then the girls look pretty, and then the boys look respectable. But the children, they're all absolutely filthy. They don't get clean daily. Their faces are dirty. They're walking around barefoot. Their hair is matted. Super filthy dirty, which is interesting because the Arabs are the opposite, because they pray five times a day, generally speaking. A lot of Arabs do. My husband is one of them. They're cleaning five times a day. They're washing their face five times a day, in addition to all the other washing and bathing they have to do. So this bothered my mother-in-law. She was upset by this. She didn't like it. So she saw these poor little children, and what happens is they get these sores and they get infected. They get, ugh. She felt bad for the children. So she brought a couple children into her house, gave them a bath, combed their hair, cut their hair, cut their nails, gave them a hot meal and let them go, put them in brand new clothes. And here's the catcher though. You got to give them a couple bucks. So that way their parents don't get mad at them. So that way the parents are like, what's going on? And, but as long as they have money, everything's fine. So then they give their parent the money. It's good to go. And she did this with a couple kids. And this is what I see. I see people taking care of people in Jordan. I don't see people hurting people. It happens. I mean, don't get me wrong. Domestic violence is in every society. Generally speaking, I saw a lot of people helping a lot of people. That's the experience I have living in the Arab community for 30 years. So I'm going to end part three with what is happening in Syria, number one. How long is this exodus going to happen? And who's going to replace the Syrians once it's gone? Oh, and one more. How big is the UN? How massive and how much power do they really have? It's got to be huge, because the UN is the one in charge of all the refugee camps all over the world. It's the UN who takes care of that. Where are they getting their money to build millions of, refugee camps with millions of tents and structures in them? All these poor, who's paying for all the porta potties to get emptied today in all these Syrian refugee camps? Right now there's three of them in Jordan, and there's some in Turkey, and there's some in Lebanon. They're all absorbing all these citizens that are being exited from Syria, about over 2 million now. How powerful is the UN? Also, how powerful are they that they can build the refugee camps ahead of the refugees? The UN knows refugees are coming before the refugees know they're going. Does that sound like Syria is full of ISIS people? If that's true, logically speaking, then you would think Syria is in cahoots with ISIS. However, all the research I've done shows that ISIS simply does not exist. They're a figment of imagination. They're a tool, perhaps. A tool used. I mean, maybe there are dudes with guns going from village to village, emptying them out, saying they're ISIS, when in fact, they're a prepared ahead force whose sole purpose is to empty the village so that they can go to the refugee camp. That's what it seems like to me. And the UN is there with all of it. They're in full knowledge of everything, ahead of the refugees, in full knowledge. So who the heck is the UN? There you go. This is Kay Ham. This is December 12th, 2015. And this has been my special Palestinian report and Syrian report on refugees in the Middle East. Take care, everybody. Blessings and peace to everybody.
Hey, everybody. This is O'Hallahan from South Korea. And you're listening to Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.